Well, why don't you just tell us how, what you did, is, what your father did, and how you took over his farm, and give us a little bit of history, and why you were interested in this.
Yeah. As we were talking today, my father was a pioneer in chemical farming. He was he was the first farmer in our area to bring in weed killers. And of course, he was a hero, I guess. And he went, he drove about 300 miles with a pickup truck down to down into Iowa, and went to a place where they were making a chemical called atrazine. And of course, that's atrazine is one of the most deadly weed killers that are used by farmers today, because it has such a serious carryover, and well, as most of the chemicals, it never breaks down. But it was quite a miracle. The corn was full of weeds. They were having a wet year. This was in 1960. They were having a wet year, and they weren't able to cultivate a rotary hoe, and they came in with the sprayer and sprayed on the atrazine, and a miracle happened. The weeds were dead. The corn was dead too for a while, it looked like. But the corn came back, and but the weeds didn't. So he was a pioneer in that, and went all the way. He was a big farmer for that area. He farmed over 2,000 acres. And my brother and I took over that farm in the early 70s, 70 or 71. And we ended up going broke on that farm in 85. And we got to do what we had wanted to do for 15 years prior to that. Ever since Betty and I were first married, we had a real interest in farming without chemicals and farming small. And we had a real interest in the people being back on the land. The people were being pushed off the land by the chemicals and the machines, and it made us sick all the while. And but we never had the courage to go ahead and do what we wanted to do until we were in a situation where we could do what we wanted to do. We were under a heavy debt load all the while we farmed, so of course we always did what the bank said. And between the bank and my dad, if we ever talked organic, that was absolutely terrible. It caused an awful lot of... Oh, my dad almost went through nervous breakdowns as we would attempt to try these things, and the banker just went berserk about trying such things. And it's cash flow that matters. It's cash flow that matters anywhere in anything you do. It's the dollar that reigns. And in the last 5 years, we've had the privilege of living without the dollar reigning, and being able to live free from that and do what we feel is right, rather than doing what the dollar dictates. I've had the problem. I mean, the Bible says you can't serve God and mammon, and you can't serve two masters. And at times it looks like that's true. You can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve two masters. You have to serve mammon. And we've had the privilege in these last years of not having to live under that. So, but a lot of things happened to us through the 15 years that we farmed chemically my father's way. Things that we learned a lot from. We went through things like nitrate poisoning in the cattle in the early 70s from fertilizing pastures heavily with urea and nitrogen. And we went through things like grass tetany, which is a poisoning of the cattle system as a result of fertilizing the grass with imbalanced artificial growth stimulants mainly with the nitrogen, causing the vet explained all this to us at the time, causing the grass to grow at such an unnatural rate that it can't pick up the proper balance of nutrients. And when that gets serious enough, he'll throw the balance of nutrients off in the cattle's system so that they're poisoned then by an imbalance. We had things like that happening. We had birth defects in the cattle. This was all in the early 70s. This is all what convinced us that something was totally cockeyed with the way the farming was being done. We weren't established in the way we think now until after having seen those things. And using the atrazine on spraying the corn for the weeds, we used atrazine on the corn and fed the corn to the cattle that were going to calve. We had like 400 or 500 beef cows at the time, and then we would feed out the calves. We had them on three different places, and we started seeing birth defects in the cattle, in the calves that were being born. Crooked backs, deformities of many sorts, crooked legs. Most common one was deformed in the spine. And I started to think, well, there must be some obvious reason for this. It isn't an accident. It hasn't been happening to people in the past, so why all of a sudden are we seeing this? And so I decided to see what happened then and take... We were having birth defects in all three groups of cattle, and the vet had no idea what might be causing it. And he was puzzled, and so we took the chemical corn away from one group of the cattle on one of the farms, and the next year there were no birth defects in those cattle. And the next year we took it away from a second group, and there were no birth defects in that group. But in the third group, there still were. So then I decided that this must be conclusive. So we quit with the chemical feed, and that's when we started growing some organic feed to feed the cattle. The cattle happened to be what I was really interested in at that time. And so I pushed for growing 100 acres of corn without chemicals on it, and that's when my dad went absolutely berserk. But we had that silo full of organic corn and fed it for 3 years to just the breeding cattle and never saw birth defects again. And then I never did go back to feeding. We didn't fertilize the pastures or the hay anymore, so I never went back to feeding them corn when we didn't have any more chemical-free corn. But those things convinced us that if those kinds of things are happening to the cattle, then what about the food that we people eat? And if those kinds of things are happening to the cattle's bodies and our body and possibly our bodies, then what are we doing to the soil? We must be really throwing things out of kilter in the soil also. And what's our future if we destroy our soil? So that's why those are some of the things that led to why we became totally convinced that we need to comply with nature's standards rather than with whosever standards the petroleum is. I don't know whose they are. My grandparents on both sides never farmed with chemicals. In fact, they didn't use petroleum in their tractors because they farmed with horses. So I kept thinking back to them. They lived without chemicals, and obviously mankind had lived up until that point without the chemicals and without the petroleum. So we began to feel strongly, why can't we go back to that or continue that way or something? It's awfully hard to do once we've experienced the kind of so-called luxury that the petroleum gives us, but I think that if we really want to, it's possible and rewarding. So that's where I didn't expect to talk. I expected to answer any questions that you might have. Yes?
In making the transition from a cash flow using chemicals to cash flow without chemicals, could you describe that process a little more in terms of would you do it like plot by plot, pasture by pasture, changing over, or did you just go cold turkey and say, all right, we're going to just start it?
We just quit completely and quit with the chemicals the year we went broke. We quit everything the year we went broke. We quit with the chemicals and all the machinery was sold. We quit with the car. We quit with the telephone. We quit with school.
You started in on this 80 acres from scratch.
Yeah. And on an 80 acres that had been on chemicals heavily since 1960 then.
Now, what were your initial crops?
When we were farming the chemical way, it was corn and soybeans.
Yeah, no, the 80.
Small grains, oats, wheat, and barley.
You did a mixture, different plots, you did a number of different ones.
And alfalfa.
Were you raising beef cattle as well?
No, we started at that time having a house cow, and then the one house cow grew to 3 house cows because we started making butter every day and mm-hmm. cheese and ice cream every day. And
right. So you're starting to sell that?
We haven't. So far we're eating it.
He's got a small community to eat it.
Obviously.
Yeah, you went to horses then?
The first year we farmed with horses,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and it was just too tough? Obviously, on back to tractors now.
It turned out that with the horses, I was the only one that really could participate in the farming operation with the horses, because myself or none of the children had grown up with horses. Back when people grew up with horses, they started working with them when they were 6, 8, 10 years old, and it was no problem. But it's a problem to come in on something like that. And we had all the wild experiences, all the runaways, and everything you can imagine. We had runaways with all the family aboard and falling out along the way, and it was all pretty wild, but we did farm that way the first year. But one of our sons figured out that it would be cheaper to buy old John Deere tractors and not feed them when they're sitting.
No wonder you can walk away from
it. Yeah.
Did you go to like a John Deere A or something?
Yeah, an A John Deere and a 50 John Deere.
Right.
And a 70 John Deere.
Great track.
I was wondering, the thing that really brought me here is just the phrase simple living. What does that mean to you, and how do you think you have changed toward that, and how do you think you can change even more?
Simple living has been one of our main interests. Well, I guess it's all our main interest. For us, it all fits together. Simple living, simple farming, simple gardening, simple education. For us, it's all part of simple living. We don't believe that life has to be so complex as society has made it. And we also don't believe that families have to be torn apart. We believe that we should be able to live as units. And ideally, we should be able to live as units, as communities. But when people don't have common goals and common desires and common values, then it's hard to live as communities. So we just enjoy living as a family unit.
I like the use of your word privilege. You're privileged not to have the dollar be the reigning power in your family. And I think 80 acres, I don't know how well that supports you. It supports you and a lot of children. But I wonder, there are a lot of people, if everybody in the United States had as big a family as you do, or I don't know if there would be enough land to support everyone in the United States, 80 acres.
It's amazing how little it takes. I mean, the 80 acres, as far as food needs, it's a minute part of the 80 acres. I mean, we do an acre of gardening probably, and it takes an acre per cow. we people from the city, we have some good friends from the city who came down for the first time to see us. That's when they became our good friends. They came down from the city to see us, and they looked at this wheat field that was like 20 acres, and they said, "So this is your bread supply for the year?" And I said, "Yeah, it is us and about 1,000 other people. It's just amazing how little it takes for a few people, and how far things could go. Especially if, like moderating the meat eating, it just greatly increases the amount of people that can live off of an acre of land."
You do moderate meat eating, or are you vegetarian?
We were vegetarian from 77 to 85, but then when we started farming this way, we started with the family cow, and we had a byproduct, which was the bull calves. And we started eating some of that and selling some of it. And also at that point, it was our challenge. I'm still remembering you back there. You're waiting a long time. It was our challenge to grow everything we ate. And so the first years, we didn't have a lot of things that we really would have liked to have eaten. But as the years went on, we were able to have more and more. But our goal was to eat only what we could grow, so then we weren't buying nuts or things like that anymore. And we were finding that we were desiring some more protein, and it worked, fit in perfectly with the house cow then. So we've only been buying salt and yeast for the last about 4 years, and the first year we bought extra groceries, but salt and yeast, we went without yeast for a while, but the sourdough bread doesn't go over real big in the family.
Because I don't know.
Yes?
I've got a couple questions. First, was your trend toward living simply, did you feel that was over a long period of time, or was that pretty dramatic as you had trouble with the birth defects and made the decision to go organic? Was that a dramatic change for you, or had you been leading up to this, do you feel, for many years before that?
No, I think, in 1971 we started to have Bible studies with a guy in our community that was always a kook. He was always a guy that everybody was down on and called him strange and didn't really go for his ways or his thoughts. And he happened to be opposed to chemicals and the way the soil was being treated. And he happened to really hold to the Bible for his base for life. And we became involved with him and started having Bible studies with him. And that was what was... We were starting to become strange also then. And these things happened at the same time, simultaneously, while we were beginning to have Bible studies, and the chemical things were happening. And I suppose it isn't coincidence that it was all happening at the same time and just totally convinced us that there's another way to live. There's another way to go. We don't have to go the way that the masses are flowing.
Would you care to talk a little bit? I don't mean it to be you to have to divulge personal financing, but just a little bit of the economics in terms of like what is the value of an 80-acre farm on the open market in that area, and a rough idea of how much input you're bringing into the farm in terms of energy, for instance, or purchased goods.
That's a good question. The value of the 80 acres back in 1970 was probably about $300 or $400. And when we bought it from my folks in 1975, we bought it for $500, and it was probably worth $600 or $700 at that time.
An acre.
Yeah. And the value of that land kept increasing until 1980. It peaked around between $2,500 and $3,000 in our area there.
That's dry land or irrigated?
Dry, but it's we have 30-inch average rainfall. So it's real productive, heavy soil, and usually gets plenty of rain. And when the farm economy started to slide after 1980, then the land value dropped back down to $500 an acre. And now it's back up to about $1,500 an acre.
And you were fortunate to buy it at $500.
Yeah.
Right. So you invested about $40,000 in the 80 acres.
We did that in 75.
But for someone to start now, it would be, you said, approximately $1,500 an acre?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a real advantage that we've had, is that the 80 acres is paid for, and that's why we've been able to live the way we have. We're really thankful for that, and but they would make it really difficult for someone to make 80 acres cash flow and live off of it. Impossible, probably. I mean, I shouldn't use the word impossible, because with God all things are possible, but we always think in terms of man, and in man's terms it's impossible.
I have a couple of questions, and I hope the first one's not too personal, but I'd like to know what kind of effects, both beneficial, which you touched on a bit, and otherwise, you see your decision having had upon your children, maybe with their peers, or social involvement, or whatever.
When we began this, the first year, we told them that this was in March or April of the first year, and we told the children that you're free to do what you want to do. If you want to stay in public school, you can, or if you want to come home and help on this project, you can come home and help on it. So we had four in school at the time, and they all decided to come home and help. Our oldest daughter was in a freshman at that time in ninth grade, and they went down to first grade, and they all decided to stay home and help on the project. And every year thereafter, they were totally free to do what they wanted to do as far as public school or staying at home, and they've been staying at home and helping. And as far as their the first year was really a big adjustment for all of us. We left the fast life and all the extra activities and running all the time and having stimulation, outside stimulation all the time, being busy every night of the week, meetings and what have you. And that keeps a person going. When it's kind of like going off coffee or sugar or cigarettes or whatever, it's hard to quit. And you really notice it when you do quit. And we really noticed it the first year. It was a hard adjustment. The first winter was difficult. But after that, after we got over that part, it was nice. And life became good, and we started to talk to each other. We started to get to know each other. The kids started to get to be friends. They didn't really know each other before that, because everybody always goes their own ways. And our oldest daughter started to talk again at home. She had begun not to speak at home. I guess some teenagers do that. And she became delightfully talkative. And as far as their peers, the peers that they left there, they don't have any desire for their lifestyle anymore. But I don't think they ever did. maybe sometimes that first year was looked attractive to be busy again and stimulated and pacified and all of those things. And now they seem to get along fine with their peers. It's okay. What was the other part?
The other question is different, back to the farming. You said you took the 80 acres from a previously heavily heavy chemical use area. What kind of process is there involved in going from a chemical farm to an organic farm?
For us, a really scary process. We didn't know what the farm would do. We thought it would be solid weeds the first year. But it wasn't, and that's why we went with small grains, because you seed small grains solid so that they have a better chance of controlling the weeds. And we also wanted something that wouldn't feed so heavy. Corn feeds real heavy off of the soil. We also wanted something that we could seed in a plow-down mixture with, which would be seeding a legume along with the grains, and then that grows back up, and you plow down the nutrients in the fall again. So we wanted to be able to do that. So all of those things made us decide to use small grains to start out with. That's what we've continued with. We use so little corn or soybeans in our diet that we don't see a real need to grow those things. I mean, if we don't need them, we figure, well, other folks must not need them that bad either.
I guess also what I was thinking, are you able to sell your foods as organically grown, or is there a time process involved in the soil converting back to non-chemical, or?
If you want to sell organically, you have to be certified off chemicals for 3 years, and then you can begin to sell organically. The organic market in our area is not real strong, so our grain has been partly sold on the open market and partly to private people. Yes?
Yeah. First, there's just a couple of comments. I mean, my husband and I are up on the same floor with you, and I've just been remarkably impressed with sort of the calmness of your children. I mean, to be surrounded by five children.
Yeah.
So I just pass that on to you, and they also, I mean, their skin is just beautiful, and they're just lovely. You're a lovely, lovely family. So,
well, that's fun to hear.
You really see the sort of effect of all organic farming. But my question for you is what had to do with the electricity. You mentioned earlier that you dropped electricity in the telephone.
No, we dropped the telephone in the car. We like electricity a lot. We do now.
You do now?
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
After the first year, we found out that it wasn't our freedom. Uh-huh. We found out that it wasn't our freedom to drop the telephone. Because even though people knew relatives or whoever, they started calling neighbors and having to bring us messages, and neighbors were becoming irritated. So we put the telephone back in for that reason. But for that first year, we were without it, and that took us out of the phone book and off of all the listings and everything. And when they put our phone back in, they didn't put us back in the phone book or in the listings, or so we don't get any of the funny calls, and we get very few calls. It's nice.
That's lucky.
Yeah. Right, we thought so too. Someone called about a year ago and said, we noticed that your name is not in the phone book. Wouldn't you like to have your name in the phone book? And I said, no, we really enjoy not having it in there, so.
My other question is, in terms of spiritual support, I mean, you've obviously gone out on a limb a bit, and I think that there are other people in Minnesota who are similar to yourself, but how do you find the support to really carry on? Do you function as a sort of self-sufficient unit? You do sort of have a self-sufficient unit yourself, but.
As far as spiritual support and support in living this way, there isn't a whole lot. Our families are sometimes violently opposed to the way we live. Both of our folks are, we're really off the deep end the way we live.
In the beginning, not
anymore. Well, yeah. Although when we stopped in North Dakota for 2 months working for Betty's dad, he didn't think. Yes. He believes in the way the world lives, and of course he believes, well, whatever we believe in, we want for our offspring, and he believes in what the world has to offer, and that's what he wants for his offspring, and that's understandable.
Yeah. Are you homeschooling now?
We're homeschooling, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I asked him if he did homeschooling.
Yeah, so I think, could you talk about that a little?
That was another thing. A lot of things scared me to death the first year, and one of the things was homeschooling. We didn't leave the school because we were unhappy with the people there. So, in fact, we had a really good relationship with the people there and enjoyed some of those folks a lot. We had a really good elementary principal, and I went around and talked with all of the high school teachers and grade school teachers and told them what we want to do. And going and talking to the algebra teacher, and I mean, I have a 12th grade education, and to go talk to these teachers and tell them we wanted to teach our children ourselves made me real nervous. It scared me to death. But we've been finding that the education process, just like growing things, can happen so much more naturally than people make it out to be, than society makes it out to be. The little girls, it's exciting to see them learn to read, and it happens naturally. It doesn't happen, we don't have to force them. Betty was reading a quote out of the John Holt book that she found in the library here, and he said, what did he say, Betty?
She's gone.
She's gone. Children who are forced to learn don't learn. I'm pretty sure that was the quote. And I guess the way we felt about the way they had been learning, these are things that we didn't know or see at the time, but we started to see them afterwards. The way the children had been learning, they were forced. And through a system of reward, they were forced to learn, and at home they learn naturally. It's really a joy to see. It's kind of like watching the soil come back to life on the 80 acres, seeing it not on the artificial stimulants and chemicals. We saw the soil come from chunky cement type soil to mellow soil with earthworms in it. We didn't have earthworms when we started. And now there are earthworms galore in the soil. And of course the weed killers kill the earthworms, and the anhydrous ammonia is a big killer of the earthworms. They can't live in it. And now the farmers put it on in the fall and put in a chemical that kills the bacteria life around the anhydrous ammonia that they put into the product is called NSERV. It kills the bacteria life around the anhydrous ammonia that's shot into the soil in the fall, so that the bacteria activity comes to a stop, so that the nitrogen is stable until it's used in the summer then by the plant. And of course that kind of program doesn't care about the bacteria life of the soil. All it cares about is the stimulation of the plant, the unnatural stimulation. So watching the kids has been like watching the soil.
Do you see any of your neighbors making any changes at all, and so what?
No. Economics don't make it possible. The dollar reigns. We don't see it happening. People look and are interested, but, and for another thing, they dread having to live the way we do. I mean, to not drive, we take the car out a couple times a month, and to stay home like that all the time, and to not have a television, and all of those things, it, I think it probably scares them. Yes?
Do you, when you're on the road, or when you're away from home, and you change diet to the outside type of food, do you notice much of a behavior change in your children?
Well, we usually watch the, it's sure no problem here. When we worked in North Dakota, we lived by ourselves in the basement of Betty's folks' house. They had it set up, everything is down there that we needed, so we brought all of our food along from Minnesota. We did that 2 years ago too, and that, at that time we brought our cow and every and chickens and everything along. This year we left the cow, and but we did bring all of our food that we would need for the winter. And but they really don't have a desire for the other kind of eating, a lot of sugar and chemicals and preservatives. We do notice that in two of our children. When they go to grandma's house and have things with a lot of colorings and stuff, they have trouble breaking out and things like that. But they get it so rarely and desire it so little that it isn't a problem. We usually aren't in a situation, well, we haven't been in a situation where we can't eat decent. It's a nice thing about Holden Village.
Well, still some of the food we buy here has chemicals in it.
Yeah, but you wouldn't get the concentration of all the additives, you know, the preservatives and the colorings, and you buy relatively pure foods, unrefined and unprocessed. And
are you saying that you have, there aren't any other families in your area or that, that are doing the same thing as you are? You have no fellowship with anyone else who's doing the similar thing?
No. There's a family that used to live near us that also began homeschooling, and they milked 25 cows and owned a 4-acre building site. And they would buy the feed for the cows, and they were, and they'd go out and bale hay, and they were making a living that way. But they had opportunity to go to Wisconsin and buy a 300-acre dairy farm there that had been abandoned for years. They bought it when the farm prices were way down, excuse me, about 86. And they've been making it on there. It's about 100 acres of woods and 50 acres of pasture, and the rest is crop. So they're over in Wisconsin now, about 3 or 4 hours away, so we don't see them anymore. Otherwise, there's a fine family from the cities that comes down, and we don't know whether they like us so well or whether they like the farm so well. We hope it's both, but no, we think they like us too, but they come down and really encourage us a whole lot. They back us 100%. They also homeschool, so they are our biggest encouragement regularly.
What do you do about church? And
we also, when we started homeschooling, we started home churching and home Sunday schooling and all of that. And that too is not very well received and accepted. My father-in-law is a dedicated Christian. And he really feels that we're on serious, dangerous territory by not going to a community church. But we have families that we know with young people that watch us doing that, and with young children, and we tell them, we discourage them. It's like we've had 4 of our babies at home too, and people come and say, well, how do you do this? And we'd like to do it, and I tell them, don't do it. And I also tell people, don't home church. They need that fellowship, especially when the kids are little. But we have the advantage of having the four teenagers that we can have lots of in-depth discussion with and interaction with, and that happens to be an advantage that we have that makes us feel like we don't suffer as much from not having outside that way.
Everybody's probably wondering how you got here.
Yeah, we do drive yet.
No, I mean, what brought you to Holden?
My sister worked here in the 60s as a nurse for a summer. And her and her husband and family come here now for the last few summers for a week. And she said, you have to see Holden Village. So we came.
Well, it seems that you have cut yourself off from most of the world. We feel privileged, I think.
Then you chose us.
Have you tried any sort of subscription farming? I know that that's started to become where people who are interested in organic farming maybe buy or take contract to purchase some of your crop. Or is that... I know the Twin Cities, there's also like natural food stores that...
Uh-huh.
How do you get rid of the supply? You just said, you talked a little bit about selling open market, but how do you deal with the other stuff?
Just friends and whoever would like some, they come and get it. That's all.
You do sell it, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no.
You barter?
We barter it.
Okay. What do you do for medicine then? Do you? I mean, you have a family doctor in the nearby community, and
yeah.
How do you deal with him then on a financial basis? Can you barter with him, or
no? We pay.
Okay. How about any other services that are required or that the family needs? The same way, cash instead of can't talk anybody into.
We haven't tried to talk anybody into that.
Are your children learning to be mechanics and carpenters and do all the painting and all the kinds of things?
Yeah, that's one of the things that it's really a fun part of living simply like that and not hiring outside help or having others come in to do all the work. When there's something to be done, you do it yourself. And that's one of the fun things about having like the old John Deere tractors. You can monkey with them yourself, and you can even weld something or whatever. But on the newfangled tractors, well, I don't even dare to look at them. So these old, basic, simple tractors are really fun that way. And the boys and I have, happens to be the boys, had them apart and fixed things in them. And it's really fun. And I'm not a mechanic, and I'm not handy, and I'm not gifted with my hands or my head. I haven't thought... I was telling someone that the only particular gift that I can think of that I have is making babies, and a lot of people can do that.
Two questions, Lonnie. Do you and Betty subscribe to any magazines or do any reading that would connect you with organic farming or simple lifestyle?
We did subscribe to a lot of magazines before we started farming this way. Most of the ones that you could name we got during those years. But then we stopped all subscriptions because we stopped cash flow in the first year there then. So we don't have any subscriptions now. Sometimes papers of interest or magazines of interest are passed to us and we pass them on. But otherwise, we spend a lot of time reading in the winter time. We go to the library once every 2 weeks in the winter, and usually we take, we usually have 80 or 100 books home at a time, and that's our reading time.
And the other question is, did any of your grandparents live to see you make this change? And if so, what did they think?
My one grandmother lived to see the change. She died at 99. But I don't think that she was really perceiving, understanding what we were doing.
Can you hazard a guess to what your farming grandfathers might have thought? Any notion at all?
Makes sense.
It's nice even that you have that support.
Yeah. Betty and I didn't grow up gardening or anything. Our folks were always the aggressive. If it comes out new, buy it, and that way, and the processed foods and everything, they were always all the way. Neither of our moms or dads grew gardens, and the first year we farmed this way, we were trying to farm with the horses and trying to plow with the horses and trying to garden and trying to grow food. It was that year on a newly broken sod patch, and I found myself hollering and bawling and screaming, and sometimes I would find myself hollering, "Grandfather, where are you?" Because he knew all this stuff. And I lost it somewhere along the way.
You said you read a couple hours every night as a family?
Yep, that's always our family reading time. We spend about 2 hours each evening reading out loud together.
The whole family.
Mm-hmm.
You said you don't have a television, do you have radio? I mean, do you...
No. We're always talking about the news. Yes?
How did you go about learning how to raise bees?
That was a real picnic. Well, we just started out with two hives and read the little booklets and pamphlets that we could get on Amazon. Got stung a few times and forgot to tie my pants legs the first year, and I was wearing bib overalls and boxer shorts, and they crawled up and not very pleasant.
I don't imagine. Do you keep your bees through the winter? Excuse me.
No, we haven't been.
You've been killing them and then ordering new.
Uh-huh. Yes?
Are you going to older seed varieties that do better in non-chemical situations? Have you found good sources of seed, or did you try that?
We were talking about the Seed Savers Exchange today and the Grain Exchange. And we haven't been striving towards seeds that would do better, but we've been trying to come across non-hybrid things to grow, for one thing. Another thing that we kept trying to get was hullless oats to grow. We learned from biointensive gardening John Jevons that the hullless varieties of oats and barley have been grown since the beginning, since man started growing grains. And those varieties are still around, kept by seed savers.
Right.
You're probably familiar with all that.
Well, I'm familiar with some heirloom seed places around here and places that sell non-hybrid seeds that will self-pollinate.
Uh-huh.
And that you can gather seed from, as opposed to hybrids that you have to go get the seed each time.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I was just wondering if that was part of your strategy, just to go to older seeds.
Well,
non-hybrids.
We haven't been involved in the Seed Savers Exchange, but we do strive to grow as much as we can non-hybrid, which means about everything now, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Except the sweet corn. There is golden bantam, the old faithful golden bantam, but it just doesn't quite measure up to the big, fat, juicy ears of that everybody likes, so we're still growing. We grow the golden bantam alongside it, which we shouldn't do, but the hybrid wins. Was there something else over here?
I have a question. About your oldest is how old?
20.
How old?
20.
Do you expect your children to be leaving? Have you already answered this question?
No.
At some point?
Yeah, I would sure think so.
Yeah.
Well, I think they all know that.
That's comfortable for everybody?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't expect to inbreed and continue to... But that's an interesting question. It's a question that a lot of people think. I mean, people of society around us. Well, how are your kids ever going to get out? And how are they ever going to meet anybody else? And but they do. I mean, we socialize every Sunday afternoon. We meet with people that we can draw fellowship from. So, but that is a big question, but it seems to me that the people that settled this country, they all found their way around and got to know other people, and so I guess we don't really worry about that.
Along those lines, I guess, you talked a bit about both of your parents' reaction to your move, or the step you took. If your children chose a different step, do you see a reaction on their part or an acceptance? Man, and I guess maybe I'm asking you to predict the future, which isn't fair,
I really feel, and it's an easy thing to say, but I really feel that, and Betty and I both feel this way, that we would bless the kids, whatever they choose to do, however they choose to live. That's an idealistic way of talking, and it's a lot easier said than done, I'm sure, as a parent. But we really have a desire for that, to accept people where they are and as they are, and even if it's our folks living in a different direction than we are, we want to be able to accept them and love them where they're at.
Could you speak a little bit more about why you abandoned the church community? If you have a group of people that you get together with for fellowship on Sunday afternoons, I'm just as a pastor, I can guess why you might have abandoned the Sunday morning community, but could you just speak about that a little?
Yes. We don't gather with a group on Sundays. We like to gather one family on one family. We find for our own, we're kind of shy. And we don't that's why I feel really funny.
You're doing very well.
Thank you. Well, you're comfortable people to talk with, so I mean, most of the things that I'm saying I might be mobbed for, I suppose, in some groups, but this is a nice place to be able to talk about the things that we appreciate. So we do only get together one family on one family. We like to get together one-on-one with people that we can draw from and share together, and so that's the way we get together. As far as leaving the Sunday morning community, it's the same as the school. We didn't leave the school because we were unhappy with the people, and we didn't leave the church because we were unhappy with the people there. We don't have anything against the church or the people there. We just would like to live differently and quieter and simpler. And even if in speaking in terms of the complexity of running the church organization and even the local church, we're maybe extremely simple and simple-minded that way. My sister is educated. My brother is a doctor. My brother-in-law, her husband is a doctor of business, and he teaches at Mankato State. And she's an RN and surgical nurse and works full time. And so I'm her kid brother, and I'm not educated. And she introduced me one time or she was speaking of me one time, and my brother-in-law told me about it. She was speaking of me to some friends of hers once, and she referred to me as, I have a brother who's simple.
No.
Of course it was a slip, but maybe it wasn't a slip. But we are really simple that way, maybe extremely so, but we believe in the simplicity of that in fellowship as well. But we're really glad for the people, we're really glad for the public schools, and we're really glad for the private schools, and we're really glad for the churches, because they minister to and help the masses of the people. And those masses of people are people that wouldn't be ministered to any other way. So we believe wholeheartedly in the church and in the organization and in all of it. But we just choose to live a little differently because this is the way our mind clicks.
The one-on-one
cost. I see.
You feel your way of being would be undermined if you got too involved with too many people who really didn't accept your way of being.
Not necessarily. I don't think it would be undermined, because it wasn't undermined for the 15 years that we desired with all of our hearts to go in this direction. Because we were strongly active. We were in all the offices in church and Sunday school teacher and all of those things as far as church goes, and in school the same. And that strong direction or desire of ours was never, we always just kept going the same way, even though we were associating continually with the busy way.
Could you say a little about how your life is unbusy? What are the qualities of an unbusy life?
The qualities for us would be time to think, and you folks know all about that. That's probably why a lot of you are here. Time to think, like. For us, being unbusy is being busy. For us, being unbusy is doing things that are necessary to our existence, the gardening or the weeding, or they're starting sowing quite a bit, and the reading, and all of those things. I always say that I love to weed in the garden because I can think when I weed. When we used to farm the other way, it seemed like we couldn't think. If we were thinking, we were thinking in terms of dollars and bushels, and thinking in terms of what's happening at the bank, and on it goes, and that's the total thought pattern. I shudder to think of ever going back to that thought pattern. The qualities of being unbusy are time to think. Time to live, time to see what this planet is, what the creation is that we've been given, time to experience it rather than to exploit it and rape it, time to touch it. Those are all things that we weren't able to do when we were farming the other way. You don't touch it and you don't experience it, you don't enjoy it. You go after it like a madman with your teeth clenched and hope the dollars come out.
I can't help but want to give us information to anybody that's interested in pursuing the cultural, social, economic, and government forces that have driven agriculture from what our forefathers did to what is here now. There's a book called Family Farming by Marty Strange, the Center for Rural Affairs in Nebraska, Fallville, Nebraska. It's an excellent book, and you have a copy of it here in the library, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
What's the name of it?
Family Farming.
Yeah. There may be one left in the book.
I just wanted to ask if you thought that your farm was the effect of who you are or the cause of who you are?
If our farm was the effect of who we are or the cause of who we are? Interestingly enough, the way the land was being farmed and being handled is probably the cause of who we are or the way we think, because of seeing it abused and exploited and handled the way it was. We believe that all the creation is living, and it isn't handled as a living organism by modern farming. Does that answer it?
How close to crisis is your understanding of the rest of the farm, the corporate farm, the chemical farm? How close to real crisis are we?
Well, in terms of the water especially, I would think pretty close. It's starting to pop up here and there, little bits all over, and I would think that we're pretty close to crisis, because all of those chemicals are going down, continually being leached down. We learned from the dry years on the farm in our area the last couple of years that the farmers depend on the rain to leach the chemicals down so that the carryover doesn't destroy the next year's crop. And once those chemicals are out of sunlight, they never break down. They're continually moving down and down toward the water supply. And in areas where the water veins are shallow, it's starting to show up. Our area has deep water veins, so it hasn't gotten there yet. But it has the chemicals, I don't remember the details for sure, they have to have so many days of warm sunlight before they'll ever break down. And the farmers incorporate them directly into the soil so they never see sunlight. So they never break down. They break down as readily as the petroleum they were derived from, which doesn't break down.
But you use all the groundwater, even that that's being polluted.
Pardon?
You use groundwater that any other farmer uses.
Yeah.
So eventually your water will be polluted also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Mr. Pitchner was saying last night, that we can't affect, our little 80 acres can't affect the system. It can maybe help a little bit, but it has so little effect because of all the millions of acres around it that are being chemically farmed. But there are really encouraging things that we see in the soil, like earthworm eggs. It's simple, common knowledge, and we've even read it in an encyclopedia, that earthworm eggs lay there indefinitely until the conditions in the soil are right for them to hatch. Indefinitely, they can lay there. And when things come back into line for the earthworm eggs, they can hatch again. And that's why we have earthworms again, I guess, in our soil. That's encouraging. That's a built-in security that our Creator put there, I think. But I don't know what kind of securities He had for our taking the petroleum up and putting it back down into the water.
Well, maybe we should draw this to a close.
I really have a burning desire. I was just wondering if Betty would be willing, or any of the kids would be willing to say anything, or share anything about what I've been up to, or...
Hold it
up.
No, I'll say it. Let me make baby asleep.
One, we were talking about privilege. Another privilege that I have is Betty and I think totally as one on all of this. We just believe in all of it as one.
Well, I was talking to your daughter earlier, and I was asking if you were teachers when she told me that you were homeschooling. She said, nope, they have to learn Beth. They learn too.
Yeah.
And And also about being present at the birth of her siblings, and that there's a bonding that's happened as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And your wife, there's a passion in her eyes. When, I mean, you know, I could tell that it's really your love, what you're doing.
Do you, this might be a little too personal, do you keep insurance on the farm and on yourselves and those kind of things? Is that?
No, we don't do any insuring, except for the necessary, which is if we want to drive a car, we have to have it insured.
Sure.
So we do that with the basic, whatever it is, liability. But that also is dangerous territory, but it's just something we believe in, and that's the way we live. We realize that we could be stricken with something that could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, but we're taking a risk in everything else we're doing. We take a risk in that, too.
Understandable. I just know that that's a big concern, it seems like, these
yes,
days.
Yes, that's for sure. A huge concern.
Something that dawned on me, and maybe you already touched this before I came in, but my dad grew up on a farm in Iowa, and also as a hobby, he had about an acre of garden that he would work in daily, and I would spend a lot of time in. Suddenly realized that what I grew up with as a child was really what you're doing now, and wondering, when did the change take place? I mean, we did the mulching, and we did, I mean, the earthworms were there, and so at what point did that change take place, would you say?
When my dad went down to Iowa and picked up that pickup load of atrazine.
1960, is that what you said about that stuff at the time?
Yeah, that's how new it is. And that's how much damage we've done in that short a time. In 30 years of how many thousands of years of our existence on the earth.
I guess it tells me that when people talk about this new way of farming, it's the kind of farming that I knew, you know.
That's for sure.
Well, personally, I'd like to say what a gift this has been to have your family here, to hear your story, to know that some of the things that we're thinking about, talking about, make some sense. And that there are people who decide to give it up, you know, to the busy way up and strike out. It's, I think it's a real encouragement to many of us who feel something is wrong and that we need to strike out in some new directions. So this is a real witness for us. And, personally, I'm hoping I come to visit you. Maybe you'll have a flood of visitors. you can create a little house and earn some money.
We don't do anything fancy or scientific, and we're not much to see or to visit. We're simple people and living a simple life.
Well, I would expect you to put us to work if we came to this. That's what I would do. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.